Another one. From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
We do, but it will be in favor of the right of Palestinians to get rid of this wall and get rid of occupation.
Is the Bush administration pressuring Pakistan to capture Osama bin Laden at the height of the Democratic Convention? We'll speak with John Judis of the New Republic. But first, Israel must tear down the 425-mile wall that stretches through much of the West Bank. So says the International Court of Justice at The Hague. Then Florida reverses course and announces it will allow 2,500 ex-felons to vote.
We're glad about this decision. There still is a lot more work to be done, but at least it means that a number of ex-felons who've had their rights restored can vote without jumping through additional hoops.
We'll see how felony disenfranchisement can affect elections in Florida and New York. And we'll look at the case of the Florida professor Sami Al-Aryan as we broadcast live from Tampa, Florida. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel must tear down the 425-mile wall that stretches through much of the West Bank, so says the International Court of Justice. According to documents obtained by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the court will also rule Israel must pay compensation to Palestinians who've lost land because of construction of the wall. 14 out of 15 judges voted against the security wall. The sole backer of the wall was the U.S. judge, Thomas Bergenthal. We'll have more on this in just a few minutes. The Republican-backed House voted Thursday to preserve a provision of the Patriot Act that allows the government to secretly subpoena information about citizens' reading habits at libraries and bookstores. President Bush has threatened to veto any rollback of the Patriot Act. As the House's normal 15-minute time limit on votes expired, the House appeared to be set to rewrite portions of the Patriot Act to protect the privacy of library patrons. But the Republican leadership kept the vote open for an additional 20 minutes. Democratic legislators chanted, "Shame, shame, shame," as Republicans were seen being pressured to switch their votes. By the end, 10 Republicans did just that. And when the vote was finally tallied, the count was 210 to 210. Since a majority was needed, the effort to revise the Patriot Act failed. Republican Congressmember C.L. Butch Otter of Idaho said, quote, "You win some and some get stolen." Cotter had co-sponsored the change in the Patriot Act with the independent Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont. The Associated Press is reporting the U.S. military is now admitting that Iraqi resistance is far larger than it had previously estimated. Some military officials said the resistance now has so much popular support among Iraqis that it can no longer be militarily defeated. For months, the U.S. has put the size of the Iraqi resistance at about 5,000 members. Now estimates are closer to 20,000. And the resistance appears to be almost entirely Iraqi-based. USA Today is reporting just 2% of the nearly 6,000 detainees in Iraq are suspected of being foreign fighters. The Senate Intelligence Committee is preparing to issue its 450-page report today on the failures of the U.S. intelligence community in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. The report will strongly criticize the CIA and other intelligence agencies. Republican Senator Olympia Snow of Maine said, quote, "It is a stunning indictment of the status quo that should sound the alarm for major structural reform." The report, however, does not examine whether the White House politicized the intelligence to make a case for war. The Pentagon's claiming it inadvertently destroyed military records from more than 30 years ago that could have definitively determined whether George W. Bush fulfilled his duty in the Texas Air National Guard. Questions have loomed for the past 5 years over whether Bush skipped out on his commitment during periods of 1972 and 1973. Yesterday, in response to a Freedom of Information request, the Pentagon said for the first time, microfilm containing Bush's payroll records from the disputed period was ruined in 1996 or 97 during an attempt to salvage deteriorating microfilm. Some journalists expressed skepticism about the Pentagon's claim. James Moore, who wrote Bush's War for Re-Election, said, quote, "Those are records we've all been interested in. I think it's curious that the microfiche could resolve what days Mr. Bush worked and what days he was paid, and suddenly that it is gone." For the fourth year in a row, President Bush has declined an invitation to speak at the NAACP's National Convention. He's set to become the first president since Herbert Hoover not to speak at an NAACP convention during his first term in office. The House voted yesterday to block the Bush administration from enforcing new rules on Cuba that ban the personal shipment of clothing, seeds, and other items to the island. The rules also place new restrictions on travel to Cuba. 46 Republicans joined with Democrats to pass the measure. Republican Congressmember Joanne Emerson of Missouri said, quote, "The Cuban people have experienced enough oppression. Let us not fund policies that cut them off from their families, intensifying their hardship." The federal government has recalled 150 million pieces of toy jewelry sold in gumball machines because the jewelry contains enough lead to poison children. It's believed to be the largest product recall in U.S. history. A federal judge in Florida ruled yesterday that a Christian fundamentalist who plotted to firebomb abortion clinics, gay bars, and liberal churches should not be considered a terrorist. The judge sentenced the man to just 5 years in prison. The prosecution had asked the judge to sentence Stephen John Jordy, a former Army Ranger, to 7 to 10 years. In February, Jordy pled guilty to attempted arson of an abortion clinic. The man had told an informant that he had plans to carry out a string of bombings over the next 30 to 40 years. On the day of his arrest, he was carrying gasoline cans, flares, starter fluid, and propane tanks. And finally, the Florida Division of Elections has done an about-face and decided it will allow voting by nearly 2,500 citizens whose restored voting rights had been threatened with revocation. The former felons, many of them African-American Democrats, had been wrongly included on a state list of voters to be purged. Later in the program, in this special Democracy Now! Broadcast from Tampa, Florida, we'll look at voting issues in Florida. First, an excerpt from the documentary Unprecedented that examines the 2000 election in Florida.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
About this stunning situation in Florida, where the Secretary of State says only 629 votes, separate.
A reasonable certainty, punch in the mind.
I am furious. They give me a ballot that's illegal. They put it on a machine that doesn't work.
What is at stake is the integrity of our democracy, making sure that the will of the American people.
Many people probably voted for Buchanan, meaning to vote for Gore.
What happens? Do we go to jail? Because I'm willing to go to jail.
No, I just felt that it.
Was mass confusion at 7 o'clock when the polls opened. We knew.
an excerpt of the documentary Unprecedented, about what happened in the Florida election of 2000. We'll be talking about this later in the program. But first, we turn to The Hague. Israel must tear down the 425-mile wall that stretches through much of the West Bank. This, according to the International Court of Justice in a ruling today. According to documents obtained by the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the court will also rule Israel must pay compensation to Palestinians who've lost land because of the construction of the wall. 14 out of the 15 justices voted against the security wall. The sole backer of the wall was U.S. Judge Thomas Bergenthal. The court wrote in its majority opinion, quote, "The wall along the route chosen and its associated regime gravely infringe a number of rights of Palestinians residing in the territory occupied by Israel, and the infringements resulting from that route cannot be justified by military exigencies or by the requirements of national security or public order." The International Court in The Hague was asked to rule on the legality of the separation wall by the United Nations General Assembly last December. Israel has repeatedly said it will not recognize the court's ruling. Haaretz is reporting that the United States is expected to help block the UN Security Council from making any move to enforce the decision. Both President Bush and Senator John Kerry have backed Israel's right to construct the wall through the West Bank. In a new policy paper, Senator Kerry has written, quote, "The security fence is a legitimate act of self-defense erected in response to the wave of terror attacks against Israeli citizens. The security fence is not a matter for the International Court of Justice," said Kerry. Well, we go now to The Hague, to the International Court of Justice. We are joined now by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative and President of the Palestinian Medical Relief Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's nice to be with you again.
Can you tell us, as we broadcast this, the court has not actually handed down the ruling, though we have the report of what the ruling is. You're about to go into the court. Your reaction, Dr. Barghouti?
Well, my reaction is that, of course, we have to wait 1 hour more or 1.5 hours to have the real decision, the actual decision declared officially. But if what was stated already by you is correct, then this is a great victory and a wonderful day for the rule of law and the rule of international law. And this is a moment that Palestinians need so much, where the international community is showing that there is justice in this world and that justice can prevail. It would be a good and wonderful day for all Palestinians and Israelis who believe in peace, coexistence, and justice. And it will be a declaration that illegal acts like building this wall, which is three times as long and twice as high as Berlin Wall used to be, and which is transforming the occupied territories into clusters of ghettos and pantostans like was in the South African apartheid system, cannot survive, and it should be ended. And I think this is a great precedent in affirming international law, and it is a big challenge not only to the Israeli policy, but also to the United States official policy, which must say whether it respects international law and International Court of Justice and the rule of law or not.
Dr. Barghouti, can you describe the wall for people who are not familiar with it?
This is a wall that extends for about 752 kilometers, about three times as long, as I said, and twice as high as Berlin Wall used to be. In many places, it's a concrete wall which is 9 meters high. In many places, it's a wall that cuts, that extends for a width of 104 meters, destroying and damaging agricultural areas, uprooting hundreds of thousands of olive trees, as has already happened. It is a wall that transforms at least 78 communities in the West Bank into ghetto-like entities. The best description of that is the city of Qalqilia, which has 46,000 people, and which is surrounded by the wall completely from all directions now, leaving only one entry, which is a bath, a road that is 8 meters width with a gate, and the gate has a key, and the Israeli soldiers hold the key, and they shut off the city every evening at 6 p.m. and open it in the morning, and sometimes they don't open it in the morning. There are 52 gates in that area. Only 11 of them are functioning. Most of those are opened for 15 minutes, three times a day only. So people are enclaved behind this wall in something that can only be described as ghetto-like structures. It is destroying the whole humanitarian situation. We are unable to transfer patients from one area to the other. The health system is destroyed. Agriculture is destroyed. The normal economy and trade is destroyed. And many students cannot go to their educational facilities. So practically, it paralyzes and destroys the economy, health, and the normal life of people. That's why we lost 55. We've lost already 90 people who died because they could not cross the checkpoints or the wall gates to get to medical treatment. And that's why as much as 55 Palestinian women had to give birth at checkpoints. One third of them lost their babies. This is not a wall that is built on the borders between the West Bank and Israel, as some people might think, and then say this is needed for security. No, it is a wall that goes as deep as 25 kilometers, 11 miles or more inside the West Bank, and it is inside the occupied territories, that are the territories that are considered by international law as occupied territories that cannot be violated by Israel. It is also a wall that is destroying the whole fabric of the social fabric of Jerusalem. It has already separated 271,000 people from the area of Jerusalem, from the city of Jerusalem, preventing them from getting to their hospitals, schools, and economic facilities.
So it is, we're talking. We're talking with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who is Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative. He's speaking to us from the International Court of Justice at The Hague, where at the time of this broadcast, the decision will soon be handed down, though the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the decision of 14 of 15 judges is that the wall should be taken down, what Palestinians and many of their supporters call the apartheid wall, what the Israeli government calls the security wall. Now, Dr. Barghouti, this decision follows the decision of the Israeli High Court. Could you explain what that was?
The Israeli High Court, I think, made a very interesting decision just a few days before the Court of Justice, the International Court of Justice, I think, in an effort to preempt the value and effect of the Court of Justice. They said they asked the Israeli army to reroute the passage of the wall, but they didn't say that the wall cannot be built inside the occupied territories. So in my opinion, what the Israeli court decision relates to is only to 30 kilometers out of 752 kilometers, very little piece, and they are trying to use it as a preemptive strike to prevent the international condemnation of this wall. Mr. Sharon also came up with a statement just an hour ago, in which he said he will be ready to negotiate the passage of the wall. Well, you cannot negotiate law. You cannot negotiate the application of the law, because law is law, and there is either a rule of law or there is no rule of law. And what Sharon is trying to do is to preempt what could become a very major international effect of this decision, very much similar to the decision of the High Court of Justice in relationship to South Africa, which led to sanctions on South Africa as long as it sustained apartheid. And I think this could be the case here if Israel continues to negate international law, hurting the interest of both Palestinians and Israelis and the interest of coexistence and peaceful resolution. Israel could also encounter the possibility of sanctions on this unacceptable policy.
Dr. Barghouti, finally, it is not only George Bush who has supported Israel's right to construct the wall through the West Bank, but said in a new policy paper, Senator John Kerry has said the security fence is a legitimate act of self-defense erected in response to the wave of terror attacks against Israeli citizens. He says the security fence is not a matter for the International Court of Justice. Your response?
Well, the International Court of Justice is a court that takes decision about international law, and nobody can take that legitimacy from it. But let me say that 900 Israelis have already died, and about 3,200 Palestinians as well. More than 4,000 victims during the last 3.5 years. All these people should not have died. They were all the victims of the policy of occupation and the policy of supporting occupation and supporting the feeling of impunity in Israel to international law. I think it is not in the interest of the American people or the American public or those who are going to vote in elections to continue to support policies of Israel that are outside the ranks of international law. I think Mr. Kerry had a brave position about the war in Vietnam, and if he applies the same principles to the Palestinian-Israeli cause, he would support the decision of the court of removing this wall that is illegal and unacceptable. You cannot apply double standards. And time has come for the American people and policymakers, including Mr. Bush, to look in the mirror and see whether what they are doing in relationship to Israel and Palestinians is really in the interest of the American people and the principles of freedom and rule of law that America supports widely.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative and President of the Palestinian Medical Relief Committee. He's speaking to us from The Hague, from the International Court of Justice, just about at this broadcast to hand down its ruling on the separation wall that's going through the West Bank. All reports are that the 14 of 15 judges, except the U.S. judge, have ruled for the taking down of that wall. When we come back, could there be a July surprise? Stay with us.
شبها بیادت بکنج جدائی بیادت کشیدم مه ارغوانی شدم دیوانه دیوانه رویا شدم دیوانه دیوانه رویا شدم دیوانه
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. I'm Amy Goodman. In the latest, what would have become regular uninformative announcements from the Bush administration on possible terror threats, Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge warned yesterday that terror groups may attempt to attack the United States in an effort to disrupt the November elections. In making the announcement, Ridge and several news outlets cited the bombings in Spain ahead of that country's elections earlier this year as an example of what could happen here in the United States. In reporting on Ridge's announcement yesterday, CNN host Miles O'Brien said that in Spain, the terrorists had shifted the elections, quote, in their favor. In that election, socialists ousted the right-wing government of José María Aznar. Yesterday's announcement follows previous warnings from Ridge and other administration officials about possible attacks at the Republican and Democratic conventions this summer. Meanwhile, an explosive new article has just come out in the New Republic magazine called Pakistan for Bush, July's Surprise. It charges the Bush administration may be pressuring Pakistan to deliver a so-called high-value target, or HVT, before November, ideally at the height of the Democratic National Convention at the end of this month. Such a move would surely eclipse John Kerry's moment in the national spotlight and could lessen the boost in the polls Kerry is expected to gain during the convention. Recent moves by the Bush administration regarding Pakistan policy also indicate a deal could well be in the works that would reward Pakistan for a big bust at a time convenient for the Bush re-election effort. We're joined now by the journalist, the lead journalist on the story, John Judas, senior editor at the New Republic and visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His latest piece called Pakistan for Bush, July Surprise. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John Judas.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you lay out what you have learned and where you've learned it from?
Well, we knew beforehand that the Bush administration was putting a lot of pressure this year on the Pakistanis to deliver one of the three main players in the terrorist world, Mullah Omar of the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, or his deputy, al-Zawahiri. The question was, why did the Bush administration suddenly put pressure on the Pakistanis now and not last year or the year before? Why did they ask them, for instance, to go into the tribal areas, which they had rarely ventured into before, in order to root out these guys? We heard from sources in Pakistan, two of the people were with the ISI, the equivalent of the CIA in Pakistan, their intelligence services, a top general, and someone from the Interior Ministry in Pakistan. The Interior Ministry is not like the Interior Ministry in the United States. The Interior Ministry is in charge of the police and security, so it would be part of any offensive against the terrorists in Pakistan. We heard from four different sources that the Bush administration was specifically pressuring the Pakistanis to deliver these people before the November election. In addition to that, one of the people told us that they were being pressured to deliver the people in the last weeks of July. And this person said that the administration had told ISI, the intelligence service, that they would prefer that the Pakistanis make the announcement on July 26th, 27th, or 28th. Those turn out to be the first 3 days of the Democratic Convention. We thought that this information was credible enough and important enough that we went ahead with the article. You might want to ask me about how we checked on it and things like that, and I'd be happy to answer any of those questions you have.
Why don't you go ahead and explain exactly what sources you have on this? It's a very serious charge.
You have to understand, with a story like this in foreign policy, journalists are operating at an enormous disadvantage, and also obviously journalists from a small magazine with a correspondent in Pakistan, but not the kind of resources that the networks or the big newspapers have. Even in the United States, you can't get officials to talk talk on the record, that is, to use their names in describing what they really think is going on in, let's say, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, or any of those organizations. People are simply not authorized to speak to reporters. In Pakistan, the situation is much worse. They have an Official Secrets Act. by that act, a person who makes a leak, who talks to a, who makes an unauthorized statement to the press, is liable to go to jail for 10 years. And the person who prints the leak, the reporter, is also liable. So we were operating under very difficult circumstances, and the people we talked to were afraid to death of having their identities revealed. So we had to take enormous precautions to make sure that nobody knew that their identities were not in any way suggested or there were any clues about them from the story itself. At the same time, we took great care ourselves to make sure that they were credible, that they were who they said they were, and that to the extent that we could, that the facts that they told us, what they told us happened, did happen. For instance, the key person who described the pressure on the head of Pakistani intelligence to get somebody in the last weeks of July said that the pressure happened when Usan al-Haq, the head of ISI, visited Washington this spring. So the question was, did he visit it? And if you look in all the press reports in Pakistan and in Washington, there was no mention of it. So that got us worried. But then I called somebody at the embassy here, Pakistan embassy, and lo and behold, he had visited. And this person there said, yes, he talked to him while he was there. And we got independently confirmation from people in intelligence in Pakistan that he had visited. So that was a very important that for us in making the story and the particular source credible. So we did what we could, and here's the story. We hope that the big newspapers and the networks who have a lot more resources than we do will now follow up this story and see what they can make of it.
Hmm. You also quote the senior intelligence official who anonymously authored the recent book Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, who says he's not heard that the current pressures on Pakistan are geared to the election. What's your response to that?
My response is just that we wanted to make sure that people knew that somebody who was in the CIA had not heard about it. But of course, you have to realize that according to our sources, the pressure wasn't coming from even the mid or lower levels or even the upper middle levels of the CIA. It was coming from the White House, and it was coming from top administration officials who were visiting Pakistan. So it's very possible that this could be going on, but somebody in the CIA's counterterrorism task force would not have heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there also, John Judas, a new government in Pakistan recently?
Is there a new government in Pakistan?
The new higher officials under Pervez Musharraf.
There's a new prime minister. The head of the intelligence has been there since right after September 11th.
And speaking of. Intelligence and what has been going on in Pakistan, the whole issue of how the Bush administration would treat Pakistan versus how a Kerry administration would treat Pakistan and Musharraf, especially in regards to nuclear secrets.
Well, I think one of the things that we found in reporting this story was that a lot of Pakistani high officials would very much prefer Bush to be reelected. They feel the Democrats in the past have been much tougher on them than the Republicans, and especially with regard to nuclear proliferation. Last January, it was revealed that Pakistan's top scientist, A.Q. Khan, the father of a Pakistani nuclear bomb, was involved in selling nuclear secrets to Iran, North Korea, and I think also Libya. Ordinarily, this would have been a revelation that would have brought about great diplomatic repercussions. We cut off Pakistan with sanctions during the Clinton administration because of their going ahead with a nuclear bomb. What the Bush administration did was say that it was an internal matter for Pakistan and to go along with President Musharraf pardoning Khan for what he had done. even though it's pretty clear that he couldn't have been acting alone, that he must have been acting with the complicity of the government. So I think that one of the things that the Pakistanis believe or fear is that if a Kerry administration would come in, they would be much tougher on that issue than Bush. And I think they also fear that if they don't deliver, the Bush people will be get tougher with them. In any case, there has been a kind of deal. Seymour Hersh wrote about it in The New Yorker a few months ago, between the Pakistanis and the United States, by which we would look the other way on nuclear proliferation if they would go after Al-Qaeda.
John Judas, I want to thank you very much for being with us. John Judas is a senior editor at the New Republic. He wrote the piece July Surprise with Spencer Ackerman and Masoud Ansari. This is Democracy Now! We are broadcasting live from Tampa. We're going to talk now about an about-face of the Florida Board of Directors in just a minute.
Voting representation, we want 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 voting representation.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from Tampa, Florida. Tomorrow night, a major event at the Tampa Performing Arts Center. Looking forward to seeing listeners of WMNF as well as viewers from Speak Up Tampa Bay, Tampa Bay Community Television. We're broadcasting from WEDU, from Tampa Public Television right now as we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour. We're also at the Alliance for Community Media Conference that's taking place here in Tampa, public access TV stations around the country. And we are in this swing state of Florida. The Division of Elections here has done an about-face and decided it'll allow voting by nearly 2,500 citizens whose restored voting rights had been threatened with revocation. The former felons, many of them African-American Democrats, had been wrongly included on a state list of voters to be purged. The agency originally said that state law required former felons be deleted from the voter rolls because they'd registered to vote before they received clemency. But Secretary of State Glenda Hood backtracked yesterday amidst pressure from civil liberties groups. Florida is one of seven states that does not automatically restore civil rights to felons after they've served their prison sentences. And regaining the right to vote can be a long and difficult process. The law caused hundreds or possibly thousands of votes to be discounted in the 2000 election because of errors in a state purge list of former felons. We're joined here in our Tampa studio by Becky Steele, the director of the American Civil Liberties Union West Central Florida office. In our New York office, we're joined by Joseph Jazz Hayden, who is the campaign director at Unlock the Block and lead plaintiff in Hayden versus Pataki, a lawsuit challenging felon disenfranchisement statutes in New York State. We're going to start with Becky Steele. Can you respond to this latest news? What exactly did the Florida Division of Elections decide?
Well, first of all, we're really happy with this news. And what the Division of Elections decided was to remove ex-felons from a central voter database, they had been designated because they had received clemency and had their rights restored after they had registered to vote. And so the original position of having them in the database was then that the supervisors of elections should contact them, and if they did not re-register to vote, those ex-felons who'd had their rights restored would not be allowed to vote. So at the ACLU, our legal director, Randall Marshall, wrote a letter to Glenda Hood, the Secretary of State, and said there are some serious problems with this position. It may violate federal law, and it may violate the Constitution if you impose these additional requirements on people who are eligible voters. They've gone through all the hoops that they need, and they've spent a long, arduous process getting their rights restored. And now, because of a technicality in the timing, you're going to strike them from the voter rolls. That's a serious problem. So on July 7th, Dawn Roberts, who's the new division director of the Division of Elections, sent a letter to all of the supervisors of elections, and they've removed those people from the central voter database.
Mm-hmm. But what will happen to others who didn't go through that arduous process?
Well, those ex-felons who have not had their rights restored are currently not allowed to vote under Florida law. And that's a serious problem in our state. We've got one of the largest number of disenfranchised voters in the country. Right now, if you just look at the ex-felons who've completed all of their terms, there are over 600,000 people. And that's as of the year 2000.
So you're talking about now removing 2,500 from the list that they should be allowed to vote, but then you're talking about this huge number that are not allowed to
vote,
but they have served their time.
They've served their time. They've completed their restitution. They've, you know, completed their so-called debt to society, and yet they're still not allowed to vote under our system. And this goes back to Florida's 1868 Constitution that was enacted after the Civil War with the intent of disenfranchising black voters. And there have been legal challenges that are still working their way through the courts, but unfortunately, that's the system that's in place right now.
Where does Florida stand in relation to the rest of the country? Do you know how many states do not allow people who've served time in prison to vote for the rest of their lives unless they go through this process?
Well, we're in the distinct minority of states. We're one of only seven states that doesn't automatically doesn't automatically provide restoration of rights.
Hmm. We're also joined by Jazz Hayden. Jazz Hayden, a campaign director at Unlock the Block, sued the governor of New York, George Pataki, challenging the felon disenfranchisement statutes in New York State. Can you tell us where New York stands on this, Jazz?
Well, New York State law denies the right to vote to anyone that's in prison that's been convicted of a felony and is doing time in prison, and also while they're on parole. Once they complete their sentence, their right to vote is automatically restored.
Can you talk about the lawsuit that you filed?
Well, the lawsuit I filed challenges the felon disenfranchisement statutes, and it challenges it in such a way that it eliminates all the discussion about debt to society and all the rest of that. We take the position that the laws are unconstitutional and that they should be swept into the dustbin of history, along with the poll tax, the grandfather clause, the literacy test, the lynch mobs, and all the rest of those obstacles to African-American empowerment in this country. And as it stands now, I filed the lawsuit in the year 2000 while I was doing a term in prison. And I came out, I connected with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the Community Service Society, and Meg Evers Center for Law and Justice. Their legal teams joined the lawsuit, and we filed an amended complaint in 2000. And it's been working its way through the district court until about 3 weeks ago. District Judge McKenna dismissed all our claims, you know. I mean, a very bad decision, and as it stands now, we have decided that we are going to appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Hmm. So, So there are several issues here. One is whether people in prison should get to vote. Then whether people who come out of prison in this country who've served their time should get to vote. And then the issue of those that actually go through a process to get their voting rights restored should be allowed to vote, as has happened here in Florida. What about where Jazz Haydn in New York, where does it stand for people who have served their time, come out of prison? Is it similar to the Florida law that says no?
No, once you serve your time in New York, your right to vote is automatically restored. It wasn't always that way, but as a result of litigation in a case called Green versus the Board of Election of New York in 1971, which a former prisoner lost that suit, but right after that, New York State Legislature amended the felon disenfranchisement statutes. They were just like Florida's, and made it restored the right to vote people convicted of felonies upon the completion of their sentence. It's automatically restored. You don't have to go through any boards of clemency or the legislature or anything. As soon as your sentence is complete, from that moment on, you are, you know, your full citizenship rights are restored and you're able to vote.
We're also joined on the telephone by the supervisor of elections for Leon County in Florida, who has publicly refused to purge voters. Ian Sancho is on the line with us. Can you explain what you have decided to do, or not to do, I should say?
Well, we believe that Florida laws also protect every legal voter and gives them the right to cast a legal vote. And so we see conflicts in the statutes here. We're given a very inaccurate list that have legal voters on it. And prior to removing any of these individuals, I believe that we have a legal responsibility to, in fact, only remove individuals under Florida law who indeed are felons. So we're contacting every county in the state. We are doing research on trying to find out if these individuals on Leon County's list, which numbers some 850 approximately, are in fact felons. And what we're finding is that this database the state used is terribly, terribly flawed, riddled with errors. And if we attempt to remove individuals without doing the kind of research that would give us some degree of certainty that these individuals, in fact, are felons and thus under Florida's 1868 Constitution not allowed to register, if we fail to act properly, we'll disenfranchise voters. So that's why, to this point, we've not notified anyone who is on our list that they may be a felon, because we're going to try to correct the list first before we do any notification.
Becky Steele, your response.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that Mr. Sancho is being so careful in addressing the central voter purge list. And this is something that we've been doing, meeting with supervisors of elections around the state and urging caution and care when deciding when to send these letters out that start the process that ultimately can result in someone losing their right to vote and being stricken from the voter rolls. And the other thing, you know, we're taking a multifaceted approach and we're really urging a change in the Florida Constitution. There's a ballot initiative going forward, and so ultimately that's what needs to happen, is to either change the Constitution or through litigation have it declared unconstitutional.
The ballot initiative says?
The ballot initiative would just merely say that once you have completed your time, that your voting rights would be automatically restored. And people can look at that if they want to. It's on the ACLUFL.org website.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us again. We've been joined by Becky Steele here in our Tampa studio, director of the American Civil Liberties Union West Central Florida office. We've also been joined on the phone by Ian Sancho, supervisor of elections for Leon County in Florida, and in New York studio, Jazz Haydn, campaign director at Unlock the Block and lead plaintiff in Haydn versus Pataki, a lawsuit challenging felon disenfranchisement statutes in New York State. You are listening to and watching Democracy Now! In this largest public media collaboration in the country. More than 220 radio and television stations. stations are broadcasting Democracy Now!, as well as on Dish Network Free Speech TV channel 9415. And we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Well, at 5:30 a.m. on a February morning in 2003, officers from the FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force raided the South Florida home of Professor Samuel Arian. The officers grabbed him, took him from the house as his wife and three children looked on in horror. At a press conference later that day, Attorney General John Ashcroft accused Al Arian of funding the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, calling it, quote, one of the most violent terrorist organizations in the world. That day, the Justice Department handed down a sweeping 50-count indictment against Al Arian and seven other men, charging them with conspiracy to commit murder, giving material support to an outlawed group, extortion, perjury, and other offenses. An indictment against Al Arian had been rumored for months, but the one returned by a federal grand jury in Tampa was more expansive than most observers had expected. It accused Al Arian of masterminding a terrorist support group that thrived in South Florida, they said, for 20 years. Samuel Al Arian was a tenured professor of computer science at the University of South Florida. In his personal life, he was known as an outspoken Palestinian activist and frequently spoke on college campuses. He'd previously had encounters with the FBI in the mid-90s when the office of a group he established was raided by federal agents, and Al Arian was under investigation on suspicion of aiding terror groups. Although Al Arian was investigated for 2 years, he was never detained or charged with a crime and continued to work for the school. That is, until he got a call from Fox News Channel. In late September 2001, Al Arian was invited to be a guest on the O'Reilly Factor. Al Arian thought he was going to be discussing Arab American reactions to the attacks. Instead, host Bill O'Reilly went on a tirade against him, basically accusing Al Arian of supporting terrorism. O'Reilly dug up comments Al Arian had made 15 years earlier, suggested he should be followed everywhere he went. All of this on live international television just weeks after the 9/11 attacks. Here is an example or an excerpt of that program on September 28, 2001. O'Reilly begins by referring to Al Arian's connections to former colleague Ramadan Abdullah Shallah, who later resurfaced as head of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
Taking credit for all kinds of terrorist activity, and you know him pretty well. We've got an explanation here?
Well, I mean, when he came here, he came as a volunteer. He was working in an intellectual think tank, and he taught at the university, and then he left. He said that his father was sick, and he was going back to the occupied territories. And then 6 months later, we were shocked, like everyone else in the world, in which he became the leader of the jihad movement.
You were shocked! You couldn't understand it. He never told you that his views, political views, were that extreme. You were just taken by surprise?
Everyone was. Everyone who knew him here at the University of South Florida, everyone who knew him personally was extremely surprised.
With all due respect, I appreciate you coming on the program. But if I was the CIA, I'd follow you wherever you went.
That was Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor challenging Sami Al Arian. Beginning the next day, the University of South Florida, where Al Arian worked, was barraged by hundreds of threatening letters and emails. 36 hours after the interview, the university put Al Arian on paid leave. In October 2002, a few months before his house was raided, he was put in prison. I had a chance to interview Sami Al Arian at an anti-war protest in New York commemorating the one-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan.
You know, concerning the war in Iraq, you know, whenever you have war and oppression overseas, rest assured that you're going to have repression and injustice at home. And we must really fight very hard to restore our civil liberties, especially with the Patriot Act. It's an act that really takes away much of what people take for granted, not just for immigrants, but it will affect every single person. And I believe because there is a sunset provision in 2005, what we need to do is to educate the people about the effects of this very dangerous act and mobilize and organize so that when it comes to a vote again in 2005, that will be the end of it.
And that was Sami Alarian. He has now been in jail for more than a year. His trial is set to begin on January 2005. We're joined in our Tampa studio, where Democracy Now! Is broadcasting from today, by Linda Moreno. She is a lawyer for Sami Alarian, who, again, is awaiting trial on charges of racketeering and conspiracy to commit murder. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Nice to be with you, Amy.
Linda Moreno, what is happening to Sami Alarian today?
Well, as we sit here today, 17 months after his arrest, he still resides in an 8x12 cell. They have Dr. Alarian in the maximum security wing of the federal prison in Coleman, Florida. They have a special name for this wing. It's called the SHU unit, or the Special Housing Unit. This is a place where the worst of the worst prisoners are kept. These are convicted felons, convicted of murder and terrorism, racketeering, drug trafficking, and what have you. We must remember that Dr. Alarian is a pretrial detainee, and he and his co-defendant are the only pretrial detainees in the entire prison complex. The conditions of confinement are disgraceful. Amnesty International has written the Bureau of Prisons requesting information and criticizing the gratuitously punitive way they're keeping Dr. Alarian. Dr. Alarian is denied the same privileges that the convicted felons enjoy most frequently. He is not allowed contact visits with his family at all unless there is a motion made before the court. He is not allowed to purchase the same food items from the commissary that the convicted felons are allowed. He's not allowed tea or cheese or tuna. They don't give him adequate pencils and stationery for him to work on his case. So the conditions of confinement have not been ameliorated. To give you a vivid example of that, when he comes in to meet with his lawyers, they refuse to manacle him in front of his body. They always manacle him behind his body. And they refuse to assist him in carrying in his paperwork. So they lead him into the conference room, bent over, manacled behind his body, with his documents on his back, like a beast of burden. This is the treatment that the pretrial detainee, Dr. Alarian, is receiving. So the conditions of confinement are gruesome, and we are very concerned about that.
What can you do to change the conditions?
Well, we have gone to the courts and requested an amelioration of those conditions. We haven't gotten any relief yet. It's an open issue. One of the things that we've been told is by the prison officials that they're not set up to house pretrial detainees, and that the reasons these conditions are imposed on Dr. Alarian are for his own safety. However, it's ironic that the other prisoners in the complex really are quite protective of Dr. Alarian. So the question is, who is Dr. Alarian being protected from? Is it from the other prisoners or from the prison itself?
And what about the actual charges?
Well, he is charged in 27 of the 50 counts in the indictment. We do have a trial date of January 2005, and we are preparing for trial. This is a case that involves about a 13-year surveillance on Dr. Alarian's home, his offices at the University of South Florida. These are wiretaps that were on all members of his family and so on. So we're in the middle of discovery on this case, and we're fighting very hard.
Well, Linda Moreno, I want to thank you for being with us. If people want to follow the case, is there a website they can go to?
I think that the family has a website called freesamialarian.com.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, and all contacts you can get on our website at democracynow.org, which wraps up our program here in the battleground state in Florida. On Monday, we'll be broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, another swing state, another battleground state, as we continue our Exception to the Ruler's book and media tour. Today, we'll be at the Alliance for Community Media Conference, tomorrow night at the Tampa Performing Arts Center. Center, where we'll be celebrating Tampa Community Television and WMNF tomorrow night at the Tampa Bay Performing Arts Center. On Sunday, the Bumps Restaurant in Aspen and the State of the World Conference in Aspen. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Mike Burke, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.